This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The End of the Affair, written by Graham Greene, narrated by Colin Firth.
Man has places in his heart which do not yet exist, and into them enters suffering, in order that they may have existence. Léon Bloy. Book 1, Chapter 1. A story has no beginning or end. Arbitrarily, one chooses that moment of experience from which to look back or from which to look ahead. I say one chooses with the inaccurate pride of a professional writer who, when he has been seriously noted at all, has been praised for his technical ability. But do I, in fact, of my own will, choose that black, wet January night on the Common in 1946? The sight of Henry Miles slanting across the wide river of rain? Or did these images choose me? It is convenient, it is correct, according to the rules of my craft, to begin just there. But if I had believed then in a God, I could also have believed in a hand plucking at my elbow, a suggestion, speak to him. He hasn't seen you yet. For why should I have spoken to him? If hate is not too large a term to use in relation to any human being, I hated Henry. I hated his wife, Sarah, too. And he, I suppose, came soon after the events of that evening to hate me, as he surely at times must have hated his wife and that other, in whom in those days we were lucky enough not to believe. So this is a record of hate, far more than of love. And if I come to say anything in favour of Henry and Sarah, I can be trusted. I am writing against the bias because it is my professional pride to prefer the near truth even to the expression of my near hate. It was strange to see Henry out on such a night. He liked his comfort, and after all, or so I thought, he had Sarah. To me, comfort is like the wrong memory at the wrong place or time. If one is lonely, one prefers discomfort. There was too much comfort even in the bed-sitting room I had at the south side of the Common, in the relics of other people's furniture. I thought I would go for a walk through the rain and have a drink at the local. The little crowded hall was full of strangers' hats and coats, and I took somebody else's umbrella by accident. The man on the second floor had friends in. Then I closed the stained-glass door behind me and made my way carefully down the steps that had been blasted in 1944 and never repaired. I had reason to remember the occasion, and how the stained glass, tough and ugly and Victorian, stood up to the shock as our grandfathers themselves would have done. Directly I began to cross the common, I realized I had the wrong umbrella, for it sprang a leak and the rain ran down under my Macintosh collar. And then it was I saw Henry. I could so easily have avoided him. He had no umbrella, and in the light of the lamp I could see his eyes were blinded with the rain. The black, leafless trees gave no protection. They stood around like broken water pipes, and the rain dripped off his stiff, dark hat and ran in streams down his black civil servant's overcoat. If I had walked straight by him, he wouldn't have seen me, and I could have made certain by stepping 2 feet off the pavement. But I said, "Henry, you're almost a stranger," and saw his eyes light up, as though we were old friends. "Bendrix," he said, with affection. And yet the world would have said he had the reasons for hate, not me. "What are you up to, Henry, in the rain?" There are men whom one has an irresistible desire to tease, men whose virtues one doesn't share. He said evasively, "Oh, I wanted a bit of air." And during a sudden blast of wind and rain, he just caught his hat in time from being whirled away towards the north side. "How's Sarah?" I asked, because it might have seemed odd if I hadn't. Though nothing would have delighted me more than to have heard that she was sick, unhappy, dying. I imagined in those days that any suffering she underwent would lighten mine, and if she were dead, I could be free. I would no longer imagine all the things one does imagine under my ignoble circumstances. I could even like poor silly Henry, I thought, if Sarah were dead. He said, "Oh, she's out for the evening somewhere," and set that devil in my mind at work again, remembering other days when Henry must have replied just like that to other inquirers, while I alone knew where Sarah was. "A drink?" I asked, and to my surprise he put himself in step beside me. We had never before drunk together outside his home. "It's a long time since we've seen you, Bendrix. For some reason I am a man known by his surname. I might never have been christened for all the use my friends make of the rather affected Morris my literary parents gave me. A long time." "Why, it must be more than a year." "June 1944, I said. "As long as that, well, well." The fool, I thought, the fool to see nothing strange in a year and a half's interval. Less than 500 yards of flat grass separated our two sides. Had it never occurred to him to say to Sarah, "How's Bendrix doing? What about asking Bendrix in?" And hadn't her replies ever seemed to him odd, evasive, suspicious? I had fallen out of their sight as completely as a stone in a pond. I suppose the ripples may have disturbed Sarah for a week, a month. But Henry's blinkers were firmly tied. I had hated his blinkers, even when I had benefited from them, knowing that others could benefit too. "Is she at the cinema?" I asked. "Oh, no, she hardly ever goes." "She used to." The Pontefract Arms were still decorated for Christmas, with paper streamers and paper bells, the relics of commercial gaiety, mauve and orange, and the young landlady leant her breasts against the bar with a look of contempt for her customers. "Pretty," Henry said, without meaning it, and stared around with a certain lost air, a shyness for somewhere to hang his hat. I got the impression that the nearest he had ever before been to a public bar was the Chop House off Northumberland Avenue, where he ate lunch with his colleagues from the ministry. "What will you have?" "I wouldn't mind a whiskey." "Nor would I, but you'll have to make do with rum." We sat at a table and fingered our glasses. I had never had much to say to Henry. I doubt whether I should ever have troubled to know Henry or Sarah well if I had not begun in 1939 to write a story with a senior civil servant as the main character. Henry James once, in a discussion with Walter Besant, said that a young woman with sufficient talent need only pass the messroom windows of a guard's barracks and look inside in order to write a novel about the brigade. But I think at some stage of her book she would have found it necessary to go to bed with a guardsman, if only in order to check on the details. I didn't exactly go to bed with Henry, but I did the next best thing, and the first night I took Sarah out to dinner, I had the cold-blooded intention of picking the brain of a civil servant's wife. She didn't know what I was at. She thought, I'm sure, I was genuinely interested in her family life, and perhaps that first awakened her liking for me. "What time did Henry have breakfast?" I asked her. "Did he go to the office by tube, bus, or taxi? Did he bring his work home at night? Did he have a briefcase with the Royal Arms on it?" Our friendship blossomed under my interest. She was so pleased that anybody should take Henry seriously. Henry was important, but important rather as an elephant is important from the size of his department. There are some kinds of importance that remain hopelessly damned to unseriousness. Henry was an important assistant secretary in the Ministry of Pensions. Later it was to be the Ministry of Home Security. Home Security. I used to laugh at that later in those moments when you hate your companion and look for any weapon. A time came when I deliberately told Sarah that I had only taken Henry up for the purpose of copy. Copy, too, for a character who was the ridiculous, the comic element in my book. It was then that she began to dislike my novel. She had an enormous loyalty to Henry, I could never deny that, and in those clouded hours when the demon took charge of my brain and I resented even harmless Henry, I would use the novel and invent episodes too crude to write. Once, when Sarah had spent a whole night with me, I had looked forward to it as a writer looks forward to the last word of his book. I had spoiled the occasion suddenly by a chance word which broke the mood of what sometimes seemed for hours at a time a complete love. I had fallen sullenly asleep about 2, and woke at 3, and putting my hand on her arm, woke Sarah. I think I had meant to make everything well again. Until my victim turned her face, bleary and beautiful with sleep and full of trust, towards me. She had forgotten the quarrel, and I found even in her forgetfulness a new cause. How twisted we humans are, and yet they say a god made us. But I find it hard to conceive of any god who is not as simple as a perfect equation, as clear as air. I said to her, I've lain awake thinking of chapter 5. Does Henry ever eat coffee beans to clear his breath before an important conference? She shook her head and began to cry silently. And I, of course, pretended not to understand the reason, the simple question. It had been worrying me about my character. This was not an attack on Henry. The nicest people sometimes eat coffee beans. So I went on. She wept a while and went to sleep. She was a good sleeper, and I took even her power to sleep as an added offence. Henry drank his rum quickly, his gaze wandering miserably among the mauve and orange streamers. I asked, I had a good Christmas. Very nice, very nice, he said. At home? Henry looked up at me as though my inflection of the word sounded strange. Home? Yes, of course. And Sarah's well? Yes. Have another rum? It's my turn. While Henry fetched the drinks, I went into the lavatory. The walls were scrawled with phrases, damn you, landlord, and your breasty wife. To all pimps and whores, a merry syphilis and a happy gonorrhea. I went quickly out again to the cheery paper streamers and the clink of glass. Sometimes I see myself reflected too closely in other men for comfort. And then I have an enormous wish to believe in the saints in heroic virtue. I repeated to Henry the 2 lines I had seen. I wanted to shock him, and it surprised me when he said simply, jealousy is an awful thing. You mean the bit about the breasty wife? Both of them. When you are miserable, you envy other people's happiness. It wasn't what I had ever expected him to learn in the Ministry of Home Security. And there, in the phrase, the bitterness leaks again out of my pen. What a dull, lifeless quality this bitterness is. If I could, I would write with love. But if I could write with love, I'd be another man. I would never have lost love. Yet suddenly, across the shiny tiled surface of the bar table, I felt something. Nothing so extreme as love, perhaps nothing more than a companionship in misfortune. I said to Henry, are you miserable? Bendrix, I'm worried. Tell me. I expect it was the rum that made him speak, or was he partly aware of how much I knew about him? Sarah was loyal, but in a relationship such as ours had been, you can't help picking up a thing or two. I knew he had a mole on the left of his navel because a birthmark of my own had once reminded Sarah of it. I knew he suffered from short sight but wouldn't wear glasses with strangers, and I was still enough of a stranger never to have seen him in them. I knew his liking for tea at 10. I even knew his sleeping habits. Was he conscious that I knew so much already, that one more fact would not alter our relation? He said, I'm worried about Sarah, Bendrix. The door of the bar opened, and I could see the rain lashing down against the light. A little hilarious man darted in and called out, Watch her, everybody! And nobody answered. Is she ill, I thought you said. No, not ill. I don't think so. He looked miserably around. This was not his milieu. I noticed that the whites of his eyes were bloodshot. Perhaps he hadn't been wearing his glasses enough. There are always so many strangers. Or it might have been the after effect of tears. He said, Bendrix, I can't talk here. As though he had once been in the habit of talking somewhere. Come home with me. Will Sarah be back? I don't expect so. I paid for the drinks, and that again was a symptom of Henry's disturbance. He never took other people's hospitality easily. He was always the one in a taxi to have the money ready in the palm of his hand while we others fumbled. The avenues of the common still ran with rain, but it wasn't far to Henry's. He let himself in with a latchkey under the Queen Anne fanlight and called, "Sarah? Sarah?" I longed for a reply and dreaded a reply, but nobody answered. He said, "She's out still. Come into the study." I had never been in his study before. I had always been Sarah's friend, and when I met Henry, it was on Sarah's territory. Her haphazard living room, where nothing matched, nothing was period or planned, where everything seemed to belong to that very week, because nothing was ever allowed to remain as a token of past taste or past sentiment. Everything was used there. Just as in Henry's study, I now felt that very little had ever been used. I doubted whether the set of Gibbon had once been opened, and the set of Scott was only there because it had probably belonged to his father, like the bronze copy of the discus thrower. And yet he was happier in his unused room simply because it was his possession. I thought with bitterness and envy, if one possesses a thing securely, one need never use it. "A whiskey?" Henry asked. I remembered his eyes and wondered if he were drinking more than he had done in the old days. Certainly the whiskies he poured out were generous doubles. "What's troubling you, Henry?" I had long abandoned that novel about the senior civil servant. I wasn't looking for copy any longer. "Sarah," he said. Would I have been frightened if he had said that in just that way 2 years ago? No. I think I should have been overjoyed. One gets so hopelessly tired of deception. I would have welcomed the open fight, if only because there might have been a chance, however small, that through some error of tactics on his side I might have won. And there has never been a time in my life before or since when I have so much wanted to win. I have never had so strong a desire even to write a good book. He looked up at me with those red-rimmed eyes and said, "Bendrix, I'm afraid." I could no longer patronize him. He was one of misery's graduates. He had passed in the same school, and for the first time, I thought of him as an equal. I remember there was one of those early brown photographs in an Oxford frame on his desk. The photograph of his father, and looking at it, I thought how like the photograph was to Henry. It had been taken at about the same age, the middle 40s. And how unlike. It wasn't the moustache that made it different. It was the Victorian look of confidence, of being at home in the world and knowing the way around, and suddenly I felt again that friendly sense of companionship. I liked him better than I would have liked his father, who had been in the Treasury. We were fellow strangers. "What is it you're afraid of, Henry?" He sat down in an easy chair as though somebody had pushed him and said with disgust, "Bendrix, I've always thought the worst things, the very worst a man could do." I should certainly have been on tenterhooks in those other days. Strange to me. And how infinitely dreary the serenity of innocence. "You know you can trust me, Henry." It was possible, I thought, that she had kept a letter, though I had written so few. It is a professional risk that authors run. Women are apt to exaggerate the importance of their lovers, and they never foresee the disappointing day when an indiscreet letter will appear marked "interesting" in an autograph catalogue priced at 5 shillings. "Take a look at this, then," Henry said. He held a letter out to me. It was not in my handwriting. "Go on, read it," Henry said. It was from some friend of Henry's, and he wrote, "I suggest the man you want to help should apply to a fellow called Savage, 159 Vigo Street. I found him able and discreet, and his employees seem less nauseous than those chaps usually are." "I don't understand, Henry. I wrote to this man and said that an acquaintance of mine had asked my advice about private detective agencies." "It's terrible, Bendrix. He must have seen through the pretense."
"You really mean..." "I haven't done anything about it, but there the letter sits on my desk reminding me. It seems so silly, doesn't it, that I can trust her absolutely not to read it, though she comes in here 12 times a day. I don't even put it away in a drawer. And yet I can't trust... She's out for a walk now. A walk, Bendrix.
The rain had penetrated his guard also, and he held the edge of his sleeve towards the gas fire. I'm sorry. You were always a special friend of hers, Bendrix. They always say, don't they, that a husband is the last person, really, to know the kind of woman. I thought tonight, when I saw you on the common, that if I told you and you laughed at me, I might be able to burn the letter. He sat there with his damp arm extended, looking away from me. I had never felt less like laughing, and yet I would have liked to laugh if I had been able. I said, "It's not the sort of situation one laughs at, even if it is fantastic to think." He asked me longingly, "It is fantastic. You do think that I'm a fool, don't you?" I would willingly have laughed a moment before, and yet now, when I only had to lie, all the old jealousies returned. Are husband and wife so much one flesh that if one hates the wife, one has to hate the husband too? His question reminded me of how easy he had been to deceive. So easy that he seemed to me almost a conniver at his wife's unfaithfulness. Like the man who leaves loose notes in a hotel bedroom connives at theft, and I hated him for the very quality which had once helped my love. The sleeve of his jacket steamed away in front of the gas, and he repeated, still looking away from me, "Of course, I can tell you think me a fool." Then the demon spoke. "Oh, no, I don't think you a fool, Henry." "You mean you really think it's possible?" "Of course it's possible. Sarah's human," he said indignantly. "And I always thought you were her friend." As though it was I who had written the letter. "Of course," I said. "You know her so much better than I ever did." "In some ways," he said gloomily. And I knew he was thinking of the very ways in which I had known her the best. "You asked me, Henry, if I thought you were a fool. I only said there was nothing foolish in the idea. I said nothing against Sarah." "I know, Bendrix, I'm sorry. I haven't been sleeping well lately. I wake up in the night wondering what to do about this wretched letter." "Burn it." "I wish I could." He still had it in his hand, and for a moment I really thought he was going to set it alight. "Or go and see Mr. Savage," I said. "But I can't pretend to him that I'm not her husband. Just think, Bendrix, of sitting there in front of a desk in a chair all the other jealous husbands have sat in, telling the same story. Do you think there's a waiting room so that we can see each other's faces as we pass through?" Strange, I thought, you would almost have taken Henry for an imaginative man. I felt my superiority shaken, and the old desire to tease awoke in me again. I said, "Why not let me go, Henry?" "You?" I wondered for a moment if I'd gone too far, if even Henry might begin to suspect. "Yes," I said, playing with the danger, for what did it matter now if Henry learnt a little about the past? It would be good for him, and perhaps teach him to control his wife better. "I could pretend to be a jealous lover," I went on. "Jealous lovers are more respectable, less ridiculous than jealous husbands. They are supported by the weight of literature. Betrayed lovers are tragic, never comic. Think of Troilus. I shan't lose my amour propre when I interview Mr. Savage." Henry's sleeve had dried, but he still held it towards the fire, and now the cloth began to scorch. He said, "Would you really do that for me, Bendrix?" And there were tears in his eyes, as though he had never expected or deserved this supreme mark of friendship. "Of course I would. Your sleeve's burning, Henry." He looked at it as though it belonged to someone else. "But this is fantastic," he said. "I don't know what I've been thinking about. First to tell you, then to ask you this. One can't spy on one's wife through a friend, and that friend pretend to be her lover." "Oh, it's not done," I said. "But neither is adultery or theft or running away from the enemy's fire. The not done things are done every day, Henry, as part of modern life. I've done most of them myself." He said, "You're a good chap, Bendrix." All I needed was a proper talk to clear my head. And this time he really did hold the letter to the gas flame. When he had laid the last scrap in the ashtray, I said, "The name was Savage, and the address either 159 or 169 Vigo Street." "Forget it," Henry said. "Forget what I've told you. It doesn't make sense. I've been getting bad headaches lately. I'll see a doctor." "That was the door," I said. "Sarah's come in." Oh, he said, that will be the maid. She's been to the pictures. No, it was Sarah Stepp. He went to the door and opened it, and automatically his face fell into the absurd lines of gentleness and affection. I had always been irritated by that mechanical response to her presence because it meant nothing. One cannot always welcome a woman's presence even if one is in love, and I believed Sarah when she told me that they had never been in love. There was more genuine welcome, I believe, in my moments of hate and distrust. At least to me she was a person in her own right, not part of a house like a bit of porcelain to be handled with care. "Sarah," he called. "Sarah," spacing the syllables with an unbearable falsity. How can I make a stranger see her? As she stopped in the hall at the foot of the stairs and turned to us. I have never been able to describe even my fictitious characters except by their actions. It has always seemed to me that in a novel the reader should be allowed to imagine a character in any way he chooses. I do not want to supply him with ready-made illustrations. Now I am betrayed by my own technique, for I do not want any other woman substituted for Sarah. I want the reader to see the one broad forehead and bold mouth, the conformation of the skull. But all I can convey is an indeterminate figure turning in the dripping mackintosh, saying, "Yes, Henry?" And then, "You?" She had always called me "you." "Is that you?" on the telephone. "Can you? Will you? Do you?" So that I imagined, like a fool, for a few minutes at a time, there was only one "you" in the world, and that was me. "It's nice to see you," I said. This was one of the moments of hate. "Been out for a walk?" "Yes." "It's a filthy night," I said accusingly, and Henry added with apparent anxiety, "You're wet through, Sarah. One day you'll catch your death of cold." A cliché, with its popular wisdom, can sometimes fall through a conversation like a note of doom. Yet even if we had known he spoke the truth, I wonder if either of us would have felt any genuine anxiety for her break through our nerves, distrust and hate. Chapter 2. I cannot say how many days passed. The old disturbance had returned, and in that state of blackness one can no more tell the days than a blind man can notice the changes of light. Was it the 7th day or the 21st that I decided on my course of action? I have a vague memory now, after 3 years have passed, of vigils along the edge of the common, watching their house from a distance by the pond or under the portico of the 18th-century church, on the off chance that the door would open and Sarah come down those unblasted and well-scoured steps. The right hour never struck. The rainy days were over, and the nights were fine with frost, but like a ruined weather-house, neither the man nor the woman came out. Never again did I see Henry making across the common after dusk. Perhaps he was ashamed at what he had told me, for he was a very conventional man. I write the adjective with a sneer, and yet if I examine myself, I find only admiration and trust for the conventional. Like the villages one sees from the high road where the cars pass, looking so peaceful in their thatch and stone, suggesting rest. I remember I dreamed a lot of Sarah in those obscure days or weeks. Sometimes I would wake with a sense of pain, sometimes with pleasure. If a woman is in one's thoughts all day, one should not have to dream of her at night. I was trying to write a book that simply would not come. I did my daily 500 words, but the characters never began to live. So much in writing depends on the superficiality of one's days. One may be preoccupied with shopping and income tax returns and chance conversations, but the stream of the unconscious continues to flow undisturbed, solving problems, planning ahead. One sits down, sterile and dispirited at the desk, and suddenly the words come as though from the air. The situations that seemed blocked in a hopeless impasse move forward. The work has been done while one slept or shopped or talked with friends. But this hate and suspicion, this passion to destroy, went deeper than the book. The unconscious worked on it instead. until one morning I woke up and knew, as though I had planned it overnight, that this day I was going to visit Mr. Savage. What an odd collection the trusted professions are. One trusts one's lawyer, one's doctor, one's priest, I suppose, if one is a Catholic. And now I added to the list one's private detective. Henry's idea of being scrutinized by the other clients was quite wrong. The office had two waiting rooms, and I was admitted alone into one. It was curiously unlike what you would expect in Vigo Street. It had something of the musty air in the outer office of a solicitor's, combined with a voguish choice of reading matter in the waiting room, which was more like a dentist's. There were Harper's Bazaar and Life and a number of French fashion periodicals, and the man who showed me in was a little too attentive and well-dressed. He pulled me a chair to the fire and closed the door with great care. I felt like a patient, and I suppose I was a patient, sick enough to try the famous shock treatment for jealousy. The first thing I noticed about Mr. Savage was his tie. I suppose it represented some old boys' association. Next, how well his face was shaved under the faint brush of powder, and then his forehead, where the pale hair receded, which glistened a beacon light of understanding, sympathy, anxiety to be of service. I noticed that when he shook hands, he gave my fingers an odd twist. I think he must have been a Freemason. And if I had been able to return the pressure, I would probably have received special terms. "Mr. Bendrix," he said, "sit down. I think that is the most comfortable chair." He patted a cushion for me and stood solicitously beside me until I had successfully lowered myself into it. Then he drew a straight chair up beside me as though he were going to listen to my pulse. "Now, just tell me everything in your own words," he said. I can't imagine what other words I could have used but my own. I felt embarrassed and bitter. I had not come here for sympathy, but to pay, if I could afford it, for some practical assistance. I began, "I don't know what your charges are for watching." Mr. Savage gently stroked his striped tie. He said, "Don't worry about that now, Mr. Bendrix. I charge 3 guineas for this preliminary consultation, but if you don't wish to proceed any further, I make no charge at all. None at all. The best advertisement, you know," he slid the cliché in like a thermometer, "is a satisfied client." In a common situation, I suppose we all behave much alike and use the same words. I said, "This is a very simple case," and I was aware with anger that Mr. Savage really knew all about it before I began to speak. Nothing that I had to say would be strange to Mr. Savage. Nothing that he could unearth would not have been dug up so many dozens of times already that year. Even a doctor is sometimes disconcerted by a patient, but Mr. Savage was a specialist who dealt in only one disease of which he knew every symptom. He said with a horrible gentleness, "Take your time, Mr. Bendrix." I was becoming confused, like all his other patients. "There's really nothing to go on," I explained. "Ah, oh, that's my job," Mr. Savage said. "You just give me the mood, the atmosphere. I assume we're discussing Mrs. Bendrix." "Not exactly." "But she passes under that name?" "No, you are getting this quite wrong. She's the wife of a friend of mine."
"And he's sent you?"
"No."
"Perhaps you and the lady are intimate?"
"No, I've only seen her once since 1944.
"I'm afraid I don't quite understand. This is a watching case, you said?"
I hadn't realized then that he had angered me so much. "Can't one love or hate?" I broke out at him. "As long as that." "Don't make any mistake. I'm just another of your jealous clients. I don't claim to be any different from the rest, but there's been a time lag in my case."
Mr. Savage laid his hand on my sleeve as though I were a fretful child. "There's nothing discreditable about jealousy, Mr. Bendrix. I always salute it as the mark of true love. Now, this lady we're discussing, you have reason to suppose that she is now intimate with another?"
"Her husband thinks that she's deceiving him. She has private meetings. She lies about where she's been. She has secrets."
"Ah, secrets, yes.
There may be nothing in it, of course."
"In my long experience, Mr. Bendrix, there almost invariably is."
As though he had sufficiently reassured me now to go ahead with the treatment, Mr. Savage returned to his desk and prepared to write. Name, address, husband's occupation. With his pencil poised for a note, Mr. Savage asked, "Does Mr. Miles know of this interview?"
"No."
"Our man mustn't be observed by Mr. Miles?"
"Certainly not."
"It adds a complication. I may show him your reports later, I don't know."
"Can you give me any facts about the household? Is there a maid?"
"Yes."
"Her age?" "I wouldn't know. 38. "You don't know if she has any followers?"
"No, and I don't know her grandmother's name."
Mr. Savage gave me a patient smile. I thought for a moment that he planned to leave his desk and pat me down again. "I can see, Mr. Bendricks, that you haven't had experience of inquiries. A maid's very relevant. She can tell us so much about her mistress's habits, if she is willing. You'd be surprised what a lot is relevant, even to the simplest inquiry."
He certainly, that morning, proved his point. He covered pages with his small, scratchy handwriting. Once, he broke off his questions to ask me,
"Would you object, if it was urgently necessary, to my man coming to your house?"
I told him I didn't mind, and immediately felt as though I were admitting some infection to my own room.
"If it could be avoided." Of course, I understand."
And I really believe he did understand. I could have told him that his man's presence would be like dust over the furniture and stain my books like soot, and he would have felt no surprise or irritation. I have a passion for writing on clean, single-lined foolscap. A smear, a T-mark on a page makes it unusable. And a fantastic notion took me that I must keep my paper locked up in case of an unsavory visitor. I said it would be easier if he gave me warning.
"Certainly, but it's not always possible."
"Your address, Mr. Bendricks, and your telephone number?"
"It's not a private line. My landlady has an extension."
"All my men use great discretion. Would you want the reports weekly, or would you prefer only to receive the finished inquiry?"
"Weekly."
"It may never be finished. There's probably nothing to find out."
"Have you often been to your doctor and found nothing wrong?" "You know, Mr. Bendricks, the fact that a man feels the need of our services almost invariably means that there is something to report."
I suppose I was lucky to have Mr. Savage to deal with. He had been recommended as being less disagreeable than men of his profession usually are. But nevertheless, I found his assurance detestable. It isn't, when you come to think of it, a quite respectable trade, the detection of the innocent, for aren't lovers nearly always innocent? They have committed no crime. They are certain in their own minds that they have done no wrong. As long as no one but myself is hurt, the old tag is ready on their lips, and love, of course, excuses everything. So they believe, and so I used to believe in the days when I loved. And when we came to the charges, Mr. Savage was surprisingly moderate. 3 guineas a day and expenses, which must be approved, of course. He explained them to me as the odd coffee, you know, and sometimes our man has to stand and drink. I made a feeble joke about not approving whiskey, but Mr. Savage didn't detect the humour.
"I knew a case," he told me, "when a month's inquiry was saved by a double at the proper time. The cheapest whiskey my client ever paid for."
He explained that some of his clients like to have a daily account, but I told him I would be satisfied with a weekly one. The whole affair had gone very briskly. He had almost convinced me by the time I came out into Vigo Street that this was the kind of interview which happened to all men, sooner or later.
Chapter 3.
"And if there's anything more you could tell me that would be relevant?"
I remembered Mr. Savage had said. A detective must find it as important as a novelist to amass his trivial material before picking out the right clue. But how difficult that picking out is. The release of the real subject. The enormous pressure of the outside world weighs on us like a pen forte dure. Now that I come to write my own story, the problem is still the same. But worse, there are so many more facts, now that I have not to invent them. How can I disinter the human character from the heavy scene? The daily newspaper, the daily meal, the traffic grinding towards Battersea, the gulls coming up from the Thames looking for bread, and the early summer of 1939 glinting on the park where the children sailed their boats. One of those bright, condemned pre-war summers. I wondered whether, if I thought long enough, I could detect, at the party Henry had given, her future lover. We saw each other for the first time drinking bad South African sherry because of the war in Spain. I noticed Sarah, I think, because she was happy. In those years, the sense of happiness had been a long while dying under the coming storm. One detected it in drunken people, in children, seldom elsewhere. I liked her at once because she said she had read my books and left the subject there. I found myself treated at once as a human being rather than as an author. I had no idea whatever of falling in love with her. For one thing, she was beautiful. And beautiful women, especially if they are intelligent, also stir some deep feeling of inferiority in me. I don't know whether psychologists have yet named the Cophetua complex, but I have always found it hard to feel sexual desire without some sense of superiority, mental or physical. All I noticed about her that first time was her beauty and her happiness and her way of touching people with her hands as though she loved them. I could only recall one thing she said to me apart from that statement with which she began. "You do seem to dislike a lot of people." Perhaps I had been talking smartly about my fellow writers. I don't remember. What a summer it was. I'm not going to try and name the month. Exactly, I should have to go back to it through so much pain. But I remember leaving the hot and crowded room after drinking too much bad sherry and walking on the common with Henry. The sun was falling flat across the common and the grass was pale with it. In the distance, the houses were the houses in a Victorian print, small and precisely drawn and quiet. Only one child cried a long way off. The 18th-century church stood like a toy in an island of grass. The toy could be left outside in the dark, in the dry, unbreakable weather. It was the hour when you make confidences to a stranger. Henry said, "How happy we could all be." "Yes." I felt an enormous liking for him standing there on the common, away from his own party, with tears in his eyes. I said, "You've got a lovely house." "My wife found it." I had met him only a week ago at another party. He was in the Ministry of Pensions in those days, and I had buttonholed him for the sake of my material. 2 days later came the card. I learned later that Sarah had got him to send it. "Have you been married long?" I asked him. 10 years. "I thought your wife was charming." "She's a great help to me," he said. Poor Henry. But why should I say poor Henry? Didn't he possess, in the end, the winning cards? The cards of gentleness, humility, and trust. "I must be going back," he said. "I mustn't leave it all to her, Bendix." And he laid his hand on my arm as though we'd known each other a year. Had he learnt the gesture from her? Married people grow like each other. We walked back side by side, and as we opened the hall door, I saw, reflected in a mirror from an alcove, two people separating as though from a kiss. One was Sarah. I looked at Henry. Either he had not seen, or he did not care. Or else, I thought, what an unhappy man he must be. Would Mr. Savage have considered that scene relevant? It was not, I learned later, a lover who was kissing her. It was one of Henry's colleagues at the Ministry of Pensions, whose wife had run away with an able seaman the week before. She had met him for the first time that day, and it seems unlikely that he would still be part of the scene from which I had been so firmly excluded. Love doesn't take as long as that to work itself out. I would have liked to have left that past time alone, for as I write of 1939, I feel all my hatred returning. Hatred seems to operate the same glands as love. It even produces the same actions. If we had not been taught how to interpret the story of the passion, would we have been able to say from their actions alone whether it was the jealous Judas or the cowardly Peter who loved Christ?
Chapter 4 When I got home from Mr. Savage's, and my landlady told me that Mrs. Miles had been on the telephone, I felt the elation I used to feel when I heard the front door close and her step in the hall. I had a wild hope that the sight of me a few days before had woken not love, of course, but a sentiment, a memory which I might work on. At the time, it seemed to me that if I could have her once more, however quickly and crudely and unsatisfactorily, I would be at peace again. I would have washed her out of my system, and afterwards I would leave her, not she, me. It was odd, after 18 months' silence, dialing that number. Macaulay's 7753. And odder still that I had to look it up in my address book because I was uncertain of the last digit. I sat, listening to the ringing tone, and I wondered whether Henry was back yet from the ministry and what I should say if he answered. Then I realized there was nothing wrong any more with the truth. Lies had deserted me, and I felt as lonely as though they had been my only friends. The voice of a highly trained maid repeated the number into my eardrum. I said, "Is Mrs. Miles in?" "Mrs. Miles?" "Isn't that Macaulay's 7753? "Yes." "I want to speak to Mrs. Miles." "You've got the wrong number." And she rang off. It had never occurred to me that the small things altered too, with time. I looked up Miles in the directory, but the old number was still there. The directory was more than a year out of date. I was just going to dial inquiries when the telephone rang again, and it was Sarah herself. She said, with some embarrassment, "Is that you?" She had never called me by any name, and now, without her old terms of affection, she was at a loss. I said, "Bendrick speaking." "This is Sarah. Didn't you get my message?" "Oh, I was going to ring you, but I had to finish an article. By the way, I don't think I've got your number now. It's in the book, I suppose." "No, not yet. We've changed. It's Macaulay 6204. I wanted to ask you something." "Yes?" "Nothing very dreadful. I wanted to have lunch with you, that's all." "Of course, I'd be delighted. When?" "You couldn't manage tomorrow." "No, not tomorrow. You see, I've simply got to get this article."
"Wednesday?"
"Would Thursday do?"
"Yes," she said, and I could almost imagine disappointment in a monosyllable. So our pride deceives us.
"Then I'll meet you at the Café Royal at 1.
"It's good of you," she said, and I could tell from her voice that she meant it. "Until Thursday."
"Until Thursday." I sat with the telephone receiver in my hand, and I looked at Hate, like an ugly and foolish man whom one did not want to know. I dialed her number. I must have caught her before she had time to leave the telephone, and said, "Sarah, tomorrow's all right. I'd forgotten something. Same place, same time." And sitting there, my fingers on the quiet instrument with something to look forward to, I thought to myself, I remember. This is what hope feels like. Chapter 5 I laid the newspaper flat on the table and read the same page over and over again because I wouldn't look at the doorway. People were continually coming in, and I wouldn't be one of those who, by moving their heads up and down, betray a foolish expectation. What have we all got to expect that we allow ourselves to be so lined with disappointment? There was the usual murder in the evening paper and a parliamentary squabble about sweet rationing, and she was now 5 minutes late. It was my bad luck that she caught me looking at my watch. I heard her voice say, "I'm sorry, I came by bus and the traffic was bad." I said, "The tube's quicker." "I know, but I didn't want to be quick." She had often disconcerted me by the truth. In the days when we were in love, I would try to get her to say more than the truth, that our affair would never end, that one day we should marry. I wouldn't have believed her, but I would have liked to hear the words on her tongue, perhaps only to give me the satisfaction of rejecting them myself. But she never played that game of make-believe. And then, suddenly, unexpectedly, she would shatter my reserve with a statement of such sweetness and amplitude.
I remember once, when I was miserable at her calm assumption that one day our relations would be over, hearing with incredulous happiness, "I have never, never loved a man as I love you, and I never shall again." Well, she hadn't known it, I thought, but she too played the same game of make-believe. She sat down beside me and asked for a glass of lager.
"I've booked a table at Rules," I said.
"Can't we stay here?"
"It's where we always used to go."
"Yes." Perhaps we were looking strained in our manner, because I noticed we had attracted the attention of a little man who sat on a sofa not far off. I tried to outstare him, and that was easy. He had a long moustache and fawn-like eyes, and he looked hurriedly away. His elbow caught his glass of beer and spun it onto the floor so that he was overcome with confusion. I was sorry then, because it occurred to me that he might have recognized me from my photographs. He might even be one of my few readers. He had a small boy sitting with him, and what a cruel thing it is to humiliate a father in the presence of his son.
The boy blushed scarlet when the waiter hurried forward, and his father began to apologize with unnecessary vehemence.
I said to Sarah, "Of course you must lunch wherever you like." "You see, I've never been back there."
"Well, it was never your restaurant, was it?"
"Do you go there often?"
"It's convenient for me, 2 or 3 times a week.
She stood up abruptly and said, "Let's go," and was suddenly taken with a fit of coughing. It seemed too big a cough for her small body. Her forehead sweated with its expulsion.
"That's nasty."
"Oh, it's nothing. I'm sorry."
"Taxi?"
"I'd rather walk." As you go up Maiden Lane, on the left-hand side there is a doorway and a grating that we passed without a word to each other. After the first dinner, when I had questioned her about Henry's habits, she had warmed to my interest. I had kissed her there, rather fumblingly, on the way to the tube. I don't know why I did it, unless perhaps that image in the mirror had come into my mind, for I had no intention of making love to her. I had no particular intention even of looking her up again. She was too beautiful to excite me with the idea of accessibility. When we sat down, one of the old waiters said to me, "It's a very long time since you've been here, sir." And I wished I hadn't made my false claim to Sarah. "Oh," I said, "I lunch upstairs nowadays."
"And you, ma'am, it's a long time, too."
"Nearly 2 years," she said with the accuracy I sometimes hated.
"But I remember it was a big lager you used to like."
"You've got a good memory, Alfred." And he beamed with pleasure at the memory. She had always had the trick of getting on well with waiters. Food interrupted our dreary small talk, and only when we had finished the meal did she give any indication of why she was there. "I wanted you to lunch with me," she said. "I wanted to ask you about Henry."
"Henry?" I repeated, trying to keep disappointment out of my voice.
"I'm worried about him. How did you find him the other night? Was he strange at all?"
"I didn't notice anything wrong," I said.
"I wanted to ask you, oh, I know you're very busy, whether you could look him up occasionally. I think he's lonely."
"With you?"
"You know he's never really noticed me, not for years. Perhaps he's begun to notice you when you aren't there." "I'm not out much," she said, "nowadays." And her cough conveniently broke that line of talk. By the time the fit was over, she had thought out her gambits, though it wasn't like her to avoid the truth. "Are you on a new book?" she asked. It was like a stranger speaking, the kind of stranger one meets at a cocktail party. She hadn't committed that remark even the first time over the South African sherry.
"Of course."
I didn't like the last one much. It was a struggle to write at all just then. Peace coming. And I might just as well have said, peace going. I sometimes was afraid you'd go back to that old idea, the one I hated. Some men would have done.
"A book takes me a year to write. It's too hard work for a revenge."
"If you knew how little you had to revenge."
"Of course I'm joking. We had a good time together. We are adults. We knew it had to end sometime. Now, you see, we can meet like friends and talk about Henry."
I paid the bill and we went out, and 20 yards down the street was the doorway and the grating. I stopped on the pavement and said, "I suppose you're going to the Strand."
"No, Leicester Square."
"I'm going to the Strand." She stood in the doorway and the street was empty. "I'll say goodbye here. It was nice seeing you."
"Yes. Call me up any time you're free."
I moved towards her. I could feel the grating under my feet.
"Sarah," I said.
She turned her head sharply away as though she were looking to see if anyone were coming, to see if there was time. But when she turned again, the cough took her. She doubled up in the doorway and coughed and coughed. Her eyes were red with it. In her fur coat, she looked like a small animal, cornered.
"I'm sorry,"
I said with bitterness, as though I had been robbed of something.
"That needs attending to."
"It's only a cough." She held her hand out and said, "Goodbye, Morris." The name was like an insult. I said, "Goodbye," but didn't take her hand. I walked quickly away without looking round, trying to give the appearance of being busy and relieved to be gone. And when I heard the cough begin again, I wish I had been able to whistle a tune, something jaunty, adventurous, happy. But I have no ear for music.
Chapter 6. When young, one builds up habits of work that one believes will last a lifetime and withstand any catastrophe. Over 20 years, I have probably averaged 500 words a day for 5 days a week. I can produce a novel in a year, and that allows time for revision and the correction of the typescript. I have always been very methodical, and when my quota of work is done, I break off, even in the middle of a scene. Every now and then, during the morning's work, I count what I have done and mark off the hundreds on my manuscript. No printer need make a careful cast-off of my work, for there on the front page of my typescript is marked the figure 83,764. When I was young, not even a love affair would alter my schedule. A love affair had to begin after lunch, and however late I might be in getting to bed, so long as I slept in my own bed, I would read the morning's work over and sleep on it. Even the war hardly affected me. A lame leg kept me out of the army, and as I was in civil defence, my fellow workers were only too glad that I never wanted the quiet morning turns of duty. I got, as a result, a quite false reputation for keenness, but I was keen only for my desk, my sheet of paper, that quota of words dripping slowly, methodically from the pen. It needed Sarah to upset my self-imposed discipline. The bombs between those first daylight raids and the V1s of 1944 kept their own convenient nocturnal habits. But so often it was only in the mornings that I could see Sarah, for in the afternoon she was never quite secure from friends who, their shopping done, would want company and gossip before the evening siren. Sometimes she would come in between two queues and we would make love between the greengrocers and the butchers. But it was quite easy to return to work, even under those conditions. So long as one is happy, one can endure any discipline. It was unhappiness that broke down the habits of work. When I began to realize how often we quarreled, how often I picked on her with nervous irritation, I became aware that our love was doomed. Love had turned into a love affair, with a beginning and an end. I could name the very moment when it had begun, and one day I knew I should be able to name the final hour. When she left the house, I couldn't settle to work. I would reconstruct what we had said to each other. I would fan myself into anger or remorse. And all the time I knew I was forcing the pace. I was pushing the only thing I loved out of my life. As long as I could make believe that love lasted, I was happy. I think I was even good to live with, and so love did last. But if love had to die, I wanted it to die quickly. It was as though our love were a small creature caught in a trap and bleeding to death. I had to shut my eyes and wring its neck. And all that time, I couldn't work. So much of a novelist's writing, as I have said, takes place in the unconscious. In those depths, the last word is written before the first word appears on paper. We remember the details of our story. We do not invent them.
War didn't trouble those deep-sea caves. But now there was something of infinitely greater importance to me than war, than my novel. The end of love. That was being worked out now like a